actually prioritize public health, because this pandemic has taught us that we are only as well as the last person to get vaccinated, as the last person to get health care.
We want to thank you, Sarah Jaffe, for being with us, longtime labor and economic justice reporter. Her new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Neil Shabata. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. Wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. And try a shield on top of it. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul.
Good morning, everybody. How are you all doing? This is Paul Rowland. I am your regular host here on Wednesday version of a talk radio here from 8 to 9 every weekday morning on your community radio station, KBOO. Well, as if a global pandemic and the ensuing economic tailspin weren't enough, and not to mention Trumpism and the accompanying thugs that have been assaulting state capitals, harassing people, assaulting the U.S. Capitol. Now we've got some serious, serious winter weather after what seemed like almost a non-existent Portland winter. I was kind of wishing for some snow and cold weather. I'm privileged and lucky to have a home that's heated, so I don't have to face the elements like houseless folks do. So I guess I'm able to safely and comfortably envision such things, but I certainly didn't wish for what happened in the last few days. Boy, that was quite some freakish February storm. And I was thinking of our houseless neighbors and how they fared. It must have been horrific. I can't imagine, especially when the wind was gusting. I mean, there was snow drifts, for crying out loud. I mean, there's like 2-3 foot high snow drifts around. This is Portland. Anyway, we've been facing a lot in the last year, and we all thought that 2021 was gonna bring relief, but we've had a few surprises, a few curveballs thrown our way. So anyway, with all this happening, and I just thought it might be good to just let our imaginations run free, you know, to imagine that the pandemic has ended, that things are, quote, getting back to normal. Of course, what is normal under capitalism? But, you know, we have a little bit more room to breathe. We can actually get back on the the struggles and efforts and everything we've been doing to make this world a better place. But I want to even go further than that, and let's imagine what a socialist Portland or wherever you live would look like. Now, socialism is a kind of a broad term. It can mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people. It's got some technical meanings. It's got some historical meanings. We'll be talking about some about that, but I'm thinking more not like theoretical discussions of, well, you know, what it would, you know, what this whole society would be like. You know, would there be money? Would there be, you know, would we be even, you know, working at jobs? I don't know. Leave all that aside. I'm thinking about where we live in our neighborhoods, the things that just don't work well in this so-called free market, in a market economy, in a capitalist economy ruled by money, where, you know, corporations and rich folks tend to control the decisions, tend to, you know, really have made the city what it is. Architecturally, structurally, functionally, what is it that you would like to see in your neighborhood that doesn't exist to deal with things like big snowstorms, where, you know, the power goes out and your refrigerator goes out for a few days, your food spoils, where, you know, you can't clear your driveway. If you're an elder living by yourself, you know, you just don't have the wherewithal to do some of those things. Maybe you're shy about calling upon neighbors. Maybe you don't really even have close connection to your neighbors. And they're, you know, there's lots of issues like that. Of course, we do have, you know, we do have Meals on Wheels that provide food for folks. We do have, you know, things like Nextdoor on the internet, which actually functions in a lot of ways. Someone put out a call for, they were stuck a few blocks away, and they, and you know, I and a few other people went, and we put some shovels and got them their vehicle safely to a parking spot. And that kind of thing happens all over the place, spontaneously and you know, somewhat less spontaneously. But I'm thinking of, you know, institutionally, things that could be in place that when they're needed, that things can I'm thinking of like things like, you know, some things do exist, like the tool lending libraries. I know there's one in Northeast, one in Southeast. I borrowed some tools that are really helpful. That's a, you know, things like that. But there should be one of those, on, you know, in every commune, in every neighborhood, you know, every single, you know, like every, say, 10 square blocks, there should be a tool lending library. I'm thinking of things like, you know, a truck with a snowplow blade that could be pressed into service immediately, you know, and someone who knows how to use it in a neighborhood, you know, that's not so, you know, institutionally, not so, you know, necessarily controlled by the city, but controlled by the local community. I'm thinking of like a neighborhood food pantry. Why do we all have to have our freezers stocked up with everything we need? Why can't we have, you know, community freezers where we can go and get food, so we don't, you know, have to replicate everything? Then, you know, that would have a backup emergency generator, for example. Let your imagination run wild. I'd like to hear what you have to say. Well, you know, on that note, well, let me first give you the number, 503-231-8187. I'm really interested in hearing from people who don't call in regularly, who are sparked by this idea of, you know, what, you know, and maybe these are things we could actually work towards, you know, if we could pool our resources and get some of these things together, you know. Anyway, so speaking of refrigeration breaking down, I don't know if people heard that the Hollywood Fred Meyers had that problem. They had a power outage, and they threw massive amounts of food into a dumpster or two. And I'm going to read from this article. It appeared in Oregon Live, the Oregonian, and titled, "Portland Police Officer's Guard Fred Meyer Dumpster is Face-Off with Residents Seeking Discarded Food." Roughly a dozen Portland police officers faced off with a small group in a northeast Portland Fred Meyer on Tuesday, that's yesterday, after people tried to take food that had been thrown away. Heaven forbid. Workers at the Hollywood West Fred Meyer threw away thousands of perishable items because the store, like many others, had lost power in an outage brought on by the region's winter storm. Images on social media showed mountains of packaged meat, cheese, and juice, as well as whole turkeys and racks of ribs that had been tossed into two large dumpsters near the store. A few people gathered around 2:30 p.m. at the store on Northeast Widler in hopes of salvaging the food. Within a few hours, people seeking food from the dumpsters began to report police officers showing up to guard the dumpsters and prevent people from taking the items. Morgan McNiff, a resident of the neighborhood, said employees were guarding the dumpsters when they showed up to get some of the discarded food. He began to film the employees and reported staff members threatened to call the police on them for doing so. I kind of sort of, in a way, feel sorry for the staff members who, I guess, were doing the bidding of the corporation. But, you know, they could always disobey. That's just my editorial comment. Let me continue. The store manager called police shortly thereafter, McNiff said, and McNiff began live streaming the interaction on Instagram. After that, other people started showing up and asking them, why are you guys guarding a dumpster? McNiff said about 15 people eventually gathered in an attempt to collect food. At that point, McNiff said, a dozen officers arrived at the scene. A dozen. One officer wasn't wearing a mask and refused to put one on until a supervisor arrived and brought him one, according to McNiff. Neither police nor the store's spokesperson responded to requests for comment. An employee from the store said they couldn't comment. Juniper Simonis, an environmental biologist and data scientist who arrived to document the police presence, said officers showed up and threatened those on hand with arrest, at which point the crowd moved across the street. Simonis said they took out their press badge and went closer to take photos of the officers who were standing in front of the bins full of food. I'm just interacting with officers and trying to get their information, and then they say, we're going to arrest you if you don't leave, and threatened me with trespassing, Simonis said. He was bewildered by the threat of arrest. I was documenting the police, not what was in the dumpster. I got to interject again, as if that was like some sort of national security, high secrecy items. Anyway, I wasn't going over there, and the police got the store manager to threaten me with trespassing. Simona said police eventually left, and those waiting to get food made their way over the dumpsters. As of 6:30 p.m., about two dozen people were at the dumpsters taking a few items each. Simonis noted that all the food was still in good condition, given the cold weather. And I will add, having dumpster dived for a long time, it takes a while for food to go bad. If it had been frozen and or refrigerated, and it was, you know, fairly cold weather, it food doesn't go bad that soon. Especially it's not, you know, it wasn't past date. One person picked up a carton of juice with an expiration date in March. Both McNiff and Simona said the immediate action to prevent people from taking the discarded food speaks to the value the city places on providing aid to those in need. The run-in also came as the region reeled from a winter storm that brought on widespread power outages that left many people unable to salvage perishable items in their refrigerators. Quote, the people who were there weren't there for selfish reasons. They were there to get food to distribute to hungry people around the city. There are mutual aid groups. Hello? Am I on the air? Well, I guess I'll just continue. Hello? last week, and it happened this week. Anyway, someone out there doesn't like me. So I'm just going to continue reading. I think this is an important article. There are mutual, this guy Simonis, who was at the Fred Meyer, is talking about that there are people at the Fred Meyer to salvage the food and distribute to hungry people around the city. Quote, there are mutual aid groups that have been helping feed people at warming centers because the city doesn't have enough resources to feed them. Multnomah County kept emergency severe weather shelters open Monday, taking to social media to ask for volunteers to keep the doors open an additional night. More than 300,000 people and businesses lost power over the weekend, with nearly all of the area's hotels filling up as people tried to escape the cold. McNiff said many of the people police threatened with arrest and turned away are regular customers of the store. Quote, I live in this neighborhood. This neighborhood doesn't have power. And Fred Meyer is telling people in this immediate community who shop here that they can't have these things they're throwing away. Cheese, pickles, yogurt, things that are intentionally cultured and cured. Simona said it's hard to rationalize the actions by police and the store. None of this makes sense to me except through the lens of severely ingrained policing and a culture of disrespect for human dignity. They noted parallels between the Fred Meyer incident and Portland protests. Anyway, so that's it's quite a good article, actually, on the Oregonian, Oregon Live, talking about the power outage at Fred Meyer in the Hollywood District store in Northeast that lost power and threw out mountains of food and then called the police to prevent people. But they relented. I'm not sure. Obviously, they probably figured they were going to get a publicity black eye. That's usually why corporations make such decisions, giving in to reality, which they usually don't. But anyway, I shop at Fred Meyer's. I would have been there dumpster diving. I actually called them as KBOO and got cut off. I don't know if that was why, but I'm sure they were starting to get some, it was around 5 o'clock, I think. They were starting to get some press attention. So, helps to have press attention. So, yeah, my point being is that the reason why that happened is because we have private control of food distribution, not to mention agribusiness and, all the links in the chain, basically. And except for, farmers markets and stuff. But even there, you have to have money. And, food as well as housing, shelter should be a human right, as we know. So, yeah, what's wrong with that picture? Why can't, at the very minimum, there be something already in place so that, as a transition to socialism, such that if something like that happens and all that food goes bad, there's a system in place to have it distributed, not even thrown into a dumpster, they actually have the numbers of these mutual aid networks, call them up, say, hey, come and get this stuff. But no, I mean, their thinking is, oh, they won't go shopping at one of the other Fred Meyer stores because they've already gotten the food they need. I mean, I can only assume that's their thinking. But that's just me. What do you think about that or any of the other issues I brought up? Looks like we've got a caller. Go ahead. You give us your name if you want or not. What do you got to say?
Yeah. My name's Joel.
Hello.
Yeah, I think you were... Oh, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah,
go ahead.
I think you were spot on with what you started with. You talked about, what an envision of a future. I think there's got to be so much growing of food in maybe new places and spaces. I know I don't have the nuts and bolts, but, maybe even, municipally funded. I mean, I'm talking massive. And then I just say quickly, if I've always thought this, if you start to just get people enough to carry on, I mean, enough joy and food, shelter, you're going to see so many other problems go away. It would be such a task. I mean, I have social work friends, and they say what they're people need often is, the question will come up, how do you feel about your poverty? That just illustrates they need food, shelter. So I guess I would say, there's going to have to still be, plumbing. There's going to be lots of, there'll be different economic realms. But I think the food production That's what people need. People need food and shelter, of course. So I guess that's what I envision. I don't have a specific nuts and bolts vision. I can't tell you, but there's lots of.
Well, let me just riff on that, if you would, and stay on the line for a second. But so I'm thinking of what happens in like an economic meltdown, like what happened in 2008. And had been happening in the industrial Midwest cities, for example, for a long time, like Detroit, but especially after 2008, the huge amounts of land. Well, I mean, you had a confluence, you had already a lot of land opened up because there had been evictions, because houses had gone derelict, because whatever. And so houses torn down. There's a lot of vacant land. And so there is also an increased need. Because of the economic meltdown, so people began to farm in the inner city massively and actually develop whole systems of farmers markets, distribution networks, et cetera. And that's the kind of thing I'm envisioning. There's a lot of land available. The problem is private property rules. So, just to be able to get the land, either you have to make a deal with the landlord. I remember I worked at a community garden organization in Washington, D.C., the area where I'm from, many, 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 many years ago, helping start community gardens in low-income neighborhoods. It was very interesting. I would meet with landowners and, it'd be like pay them $1 a year. And, basically they weren't, they didn't envision utilizing that land for a certain number of years.
Sure.
But it's a certain amount of effort. And then, organizing the neighborhood and stuff. And so, why do we have to scramble, and do often, and then sometimes people do things illegally. There's guerrilla gardens. Why can't we have it much more institutionalized and take some of that land out of the private property system and put it into the use of the community?
Yeah, you illustrate it well, because I get so idealistic sometimes. The managerial class, they're not gonna just do this. And so I guess you're illustrating it's ground up. It's gonna, it's got to be ground up. And I guess there's no easy way to organize, and that's probably what it ends up being, is organizing. And I say one more thing. I think in the future also, people will, without being cramped, people will live in tighter, literally just the, homes with X many bedrooms. And I think people, I'm talking about in the future, because I think it'll be hard. Hardship will come. I think people will live tighter and you have to learn, maybe even you cook together, and you have to learn these ways of being. And I think people might even enjoy it more than they know.
Oh my God, are you serious? Instead of being isolated and our lonely,
six people, 10 people to a home. I mean, homes have lots of space. I live in a home with, I'm living in a house, I don't know. It's, I have to go, I have a doctor's appointment, but really great topic. And I'll leave
you. Thank you for calling. Good to hear fresh new voices. And look forward to hearing other people, as I said, especially people who don't regularly call in. They're also welcome, but maybe step back for a little bit. It does take organizing. Things don't just happen. We tend to, the default is private property, capitalist, corporate control, state control. So, to do things from the ground up takes, do risk taking, even going out there to dumpster dive takes a certain amount of, confronting the police, the people, the reason they actually ended up getting that food and distributing. I saw a note from the Team Raccoon PDX, who apparently do cleanup during and after protests. Hats off to them. I saw a note from them, so maybe they were involved in this. We rescued so much food for the community today. It takes being there, being persistent, not giving up. But why should we have to do that? It makes no sense. Okay, with that, looks like we've got another caller, 503-231-8187. Gordon, you're up next. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello, Gordon? I guess we'll wait to hear from Gordon in a second here. So, I'm Paul. This is Wednesday Talk Radio.
Hello?
I'm talking about... Hello?
Yeah. Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. So, yes, it's a sad day when they throw away dumpsters full of food. And, you know, Trader Joe's and Whole Foods used to do that, too. And I work for an organization called C3. And now we go around every week and we pick up all the food from Trader Joe's and Whole Foods. And then we give that out at a food pantry distribution twice or three times a week. And I just can't believe the waste that we have that's going on. And the last thing I wanted to say is there was a great interview on 60 Minutes with Bill Gates the other day, 2 weeks ago or something, and he has literally put in $2 billion of his own money to help with trying to get countries of meat products, because meat's killing us in every way. And it's a great interview. Everybody should take a look at it and see what's coming down the future, down the pike. It's very interesting, and yeah, I'm glad that people got that food part. Thank you.
Right on. Hey, so I'm just going to say jokingly, so you're the reason that I stopped being able to dumpster dive so much from the Trader Joe's that I used to go to, huh? Oh, Gordon left. So maybe my joke was lost, but it's true. I used to get so much food from back in D.C. It was sickening, frankly. But I mean, you know, like 10 steaks, 10 fillets of salmon, 20 loaves of bread, 5 pumpkin pies. I mean, just the dumpster just full of perfectly good food. I don't know if there's a group comparable there in the D.C. area, like the one that Gordon is talking about. But yeah, and I used to do that in Portland. And at a certain point, there stopped being so much food there. So hats off again to Gordon and his peeps who made that happen. That's what it takes. Unfortunately, that's what it takes. It takes, you know, it takes constant effort and persistence and, you know, and being diplomatic, probably, in dealing with corporations like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. And so, you know, if that's what it takes, being diplomatic and maybe, you know, wearing nice clothes and, you know, having meetings with them and all that, or not, whatever. So anyway, hats off to those folks who are making that happen on a informal or formal basis. Let's go to Josh. You're the next on deck. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Me?
Yep.
Hello? My name is not Josh. Am I on the air?
I guess you jumped the line, but go ahead. You're with us now. What's your name?
Joan.
Joan. Hi, Joan.
Hi. There's one point I wanted to make. We have something called the Oregon Food Bank. And a simple organizational way of looking at these things would be somebody says, hey, we've got all this food. Why don't we call the Oregon Food Bank and see if they have a way to distribute it? So what was in the way here is a sort of way of thinking, that people are not thinking in a certain way. Okay, the Oregon Food Bank, call them up. They might have a plan. This is not that hard, and it's not rocket science. And it really has nothing to do with what kind of clothes you wear or what your ideology is. It's a way of, like, thinking about, okay, there's a problem. How can we solve this problem together? And I would take the ideology out of it, if possible, take the politics out of it, and relate just humans to humans. How can we solve this problem? I can't imagine why someone wouldn't call the manager wouldn't call the Oregon Food Bank. It's not an underground thing. And as far as people living together and sharing houses, that's very idealistic. In Santa Cruz, California, there was a situation where everybody had to share houses, because the rents were so high that no one could possibly afford them. And it was very problematic, because you had people living together who really had nothing in common, some of them being very selfish and kind of oppressive, and other people being victimized. And it really, again, takes a very high level of social and of social awareness for people to be able to do that and really share things without taking advantage of each other. So I think it's very possible to do this, but we have to start looking at things in a more elevated way. You know, a lot of the organizations that was helping around some of the political movements where people really were sharing things and helping each other out. Sometimes that can work, but it can also start devolving. So we have to look at that tendency in ourselves and each other to think about how can we make this work, and what do we have to do in our minds and with each other to be able to have systems like this that actually work, where people aren't getting hurt and taken advantage of.
So is that tendency inherent in us, or is it inculcated us by the kind of society we live in?
Well, I think it's a really huge, I think people, you know, my experience is that people really try to be kind and helpful to each other, and that we haven't really learned how yet. You know, some people have. There are people who are.
But why
really
haven't we learned how? I think in some societies, I'm thinking of, you know, certain tribal societies, I think that sharing is basically like institutionalized from, you know, that's just the way it is. People share.
Right. You grow up believing that this is what you do. If you have something extra, of course you give it to your neighbor. But you know, people, we all grow up with whatever we've been born into, and then we have to somehow organize ourselves so that we can really respect each other and not force each other into whatever molds we think the things should be. Because just calling it capitalism and socialism, those are handy, you know, terms so that we know what we're talking about. But there's something more about being a human being that goes beyond the isms. And that's the kind of thing, you know, if people were really thinking that way, they would think, wow, we've got all this extra food. What can we do with it, you know? And think that way. So it's about a real desire to make things work. And whether a guy is wearing a suit or whether the guy is wearing a parka, it shouldn't make the slightest bit of difference. And the whole land thing, of course, we have to reorganize, you know, the land reorganization is disgusting. The whole real estate industry, what the heck is that? You know, people investing and other people suffering. So where does that come from? And I think, you know, these are very large issues. I just wanted to point out that even though some of these ideas are very good, in order to make them work, we really need to be able to relate to each other in a different way.
Well, I can't but agree with that, Joan. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Always good to hear fresh voices. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you for bringing up the topic. It's really important, and we obviously have to do something about it. You know, healthcare, food, the whole thing. We have to rethink it. And I think we're capable of doing that. So thanks a lot. It's a great show. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. That was Joan. Yeah, you too can be on the air, 503-231-8187. We're halfway through the show. Seems like I've struck a chord. The theme is, you know, obviously I was talking about the Fred Meyers and, you know, throwing away mountains of food and calling the police and people showing up to salvage it and facing off with the police and eventually, you know, winning the day and distributing the food as it should have been done from the very beginning, and talking about some of the obstacles. But there's a lot of other things. I sort of brought up the general idea. How do we imagine, just say, you know, obviously the people, there were a lot of people from that neighborhood who showed up there. So that was the Fred Meyers as part of their neighborhood. You know, like, you know, I've got a couple Freddies that are, you know, roughly within my neighborhood that I go to. I go to other stores. I go to, you know, whatever. I don't want to advertise Fred Meyers. I'm personally a co-op man. I'm a People's Food Co-op frequenter. And if there was a food co-op in my neighborhood, I would go there almost exclusively. So why isn't there a food co-op in every neighborhood, say every 20 square blocks? Well, we all know why, because, you know, capitalism rules the day. It's hard to buy a property. It's hard to rent a property sufficiently large. You know, the capital investments for getting to that something. I'm, you know, Montevilla Food Co-op has been trying to get a co-op together in my neighborhood for some years now. And obviously they've been facing obstacles. I think they're moving forward. There's also food buying clubs, which are less onerous. You can run one out of your garage. You know, you can just order a bunch of food collectively and then distribute it on, you know, one day a week, one day a month. Those are ways to do that. Why don't we have, as I said, why don't we have a truck with a snowplow blade on it in every neighborhood so people can immediately access it, because some people need to get on the road for various reasons after a snowstorm. And, you know, take it from there. Don't let me frame your imagination. So let's go to our next caller, 503-231-8187. Robbie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning. Really love the topic. I was biting my tongue trying not to call in, but such an interesting stuff. I wanted to say also, New Season seems to be a little bit guilty of a lot of the food waste. They had some store closures yesterday and Monday, and they threw out a lot of food, I believe. I was able to take some excess food to the Portland Rescue Mission, trying to see that we didn't waste any food. But I wanted to bring up that Spain has implemented, I believe they're the first nation to implement, you know, it being illegal to waste food. And I don't know how well, you know, that's being, you know, monitored or tracked by their authorities or whatever, but a simple fine for food waste and maybe on how much food waste there is could easily make, the managers, because like here's the situation. As much as I don't agree with this system, the money and how this everything's set up on it, the thing is these companies are looking at it and it's cheaper for them just to throw it away compared to trying to get rid of it. So if there is some form of an incentive or a penalty, I should say, for getting food waste, you know, that might be a start.
Well, they could be given tax break. You know, the famous tax breaks. They could be given tax breaks for every, you know, pound or dollar value of food that they don't throw away. When you know things like that, those are obvious. I mean, within the capitalist paradigm, which you and I obviously agree that we need to dispense with sooner rather than later. But yeah, that's interesting.
Right.
I think I may have heard that about Spain. It would be interesting to hear more about that.
Yeah, I don't know how effective it's been because, you know, I mean, as we all know, carbon taxes don't work. The corporations will just pay the penalty and keep making their profits. But I think something like that might help it out. But I did want to say, you know, the terms socialism and capitalism, I do believe they have been skewered to the American public, and we look at it as an all or nothing type thing. But I've always tried to explain this, especially to my conservative friends who have no idea what socialism and communism mean, that when I explain these two concepts, socialism and capitalism are not totally at odds. The thing is if you have a government that's entirely socialist, that is now a communist government. And the thing is about capitalism is if you have an entirely capitalist, an entirely free market government, that turns into fascism because you have now corporations running the thing. But you know, like this idea that it's all or nothing is kind of I think limited our ability in choosing said projects, because you know, when we look at socialism as a practice, if we had socialist policies regarding, you know, our healthcare system, our food system, stuff like that, we would be able to implement more of these types of socialist things without without this notion that it's entirely socialist, which just turns off, you know, I don't know, 40 or 50% of America just because of the Cold War, propaganda that we've all been exposed to. But
I was trying to steer away a little bit from the theoretical consideration.
Sorry.
But of course you can't.
Hold on.
Let me just say something real quick, and then I'll give it back to you. But that's why I sort of threw it out. Is what do we see that we could actually envision existing in our neighborhoods that's missing? you know, food, like neighborhood food banks, neighborhood tool banks, a neighborhood warehouse. You know, I was thinking about, you know, obviously houselessness should not exist because, you know, the whole capitalist rental and private property dynamic is heinous. But since it exists, why can't we have, you know, some warehouses where people can store their belongings until they get, you know, if they need it on a temporary basis, or maybe even if they're going to get swept, if they're going to get evicted from their tent camp. Why can't they have? Why can't we have warehouses where people can store? I don't know. I can think of any number of things that would be really useful on a short to medium term basis. But just to really quickly, so democratic socialism, I think socialists would respond that it has to be socialism organized from the ground up on a neighborhood basis democratically, and that sort of can do away with the centralized state control. But go ahead, back to you.
Well, not to stay on the idealistic the ideology topic too long, but communism is actually a form of no government. It's community based, is what the idea on paper is. But as you mentioned, in the practice of it, it has turned into authoritarianism. But
that's because the state never withers away. Because when you institute it,
right.
when the so-called proletarian gets represented by a party, and the party seizes control of the state apparatus, then they tend to foster a kind of a bureaucratic centralism that then doesn't want to give up its power. That's the way it goes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll mention this. One of the callers, I think two callers ago, she was talking about how we don't want to. I think it was a little confusing, but she was talking about like how she's seen groups of people where, you know, we share things and then that de-evolves. And I think I wanted to elaborate a little bit on that because I know what she's talking about, which is, you know, when I was with Occupy Wall Street or, you know, any of the movements that you're in and you're on the street, you're there and it's messy, you're, you know, there's police all around, there's infighting, all that stuff going on. What can happen is there's people who are doing stuff, people who are, you know, constantly acting and moving and trying to progress the group, and they're the ones that are contributing all their energy and their power. And there's a lot of people, and to be fair, you know, it's always a shared thing. You know, people get burnt out in it, and then somebody else takes the role, and then they start doing it, and then they'll get burnt out, and somebody else takes on. But there's also what I think she was saying is it will de-evolve sometimes into the people that are doing things end up just constantly being the ones expected to do things. And then there's people who aren't contributing, which is something that I'm actually in the midst of writing a larger piece about, because it's a very interesting concept, you know, in trying to get that perpetual motion of sustainability, which right now it's not. And I'll end it on this. The concept of our money, I don't think we're going to address these issues. I mean, I love seeing community action come together. I love seeing community and mutual aid support. But we're not going to address this until we address the money issue, which is we're printing money, which the Federal Reserve, which is a non-government entity, is controlling the inflation and the currency value through housing rates. Those are the literal tools that they'll dial down. And just to give you some information, where I'm coming from is I used to work in the mortgage industry in 2009. And so I have a very extensive perspective of what they did and how they control the economy. And until we address how our money is printed, which with a simple concept such as allowing the community to print money, you know, we're here asking how are teachers going to get paid? How are, you know, the doctors are getting paid off of people being sick? You know, police officers, as much as I don't like them, you know, they're giving people tickets just to fund their municipalities. And why don't we just print money for the community and then pay it to the teachers, the doctors, the firefighters, the community?
Well, that's a big subject. And I'll maybe talk
Sorry
a little bit
that.
More about that. But we got another caller on the stack, and I've given you probably a little more share than the others. But always good to hear from you, Robbie. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, is there the kind of intractable seemingly intractable problems that you inevitably get into that have to be gotten into. But again, I was trying to stick for now with just some immediate things that we see in our neighborhoods that are just so, should be so obvious and are obvious, I guess, to some of us, that are just could make things so much, it could orient us more towards a community orientation in a very simple way. If we just released a little bit of the space from the control of private property and turn it over to community use and control. But looks like Camila has been waiting very patiently for several minutes. So let's go to Camila. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, this is really a great discussion. And I think it really has some themes that kind of tie it all together. And it's not the first time that this has come up, as was suggested by the last caller, Robbie, about Occupy. Occupy tried to achieve the kinds of aims that you're talking about. And I think it has to do with how we make decisions. You know, most decisions making is in the hands of private organizations. But if we could make it more possible to do in the community, as you're suggesting, it would give us an opportunity to educate and teach everybody about what the kinds of ways in which that sort of education, where everybody has a voice in the process of making decisions, we would be able to solve some of these problems that we're talking about.
Perhaps and, less, know, we, perhaps I think, somewhat less under the stress of like these heavy duty sort of Occupy encampments encircled by the police, and more that you can work out over a longer period of time with people you've already known, perhaps.
Yeah, and I want to suggest a model for this, and it's the Highlander Folk School. I think now it's called Highlander Research and Education School. But, you know, Miles Horton in the 30s thought about all these questions and said, well, what is it that we need that would allow people to come together, learn and participate in a small local democratic way to solve their own problems. And I think that, you know, what we're talking about here is getting at that.
Indeed. And what came immediately to mind was a very ambitious project that came about in Portland, in the Portland area, in the early 80s, the Alliance for Social Change, which was sort of an umbrella group of many different social change organizations, nonprofits, that came together, and actually the Alliance newspaper, which was one of the longest running radical progressive newspapers until it sadly met its end in the 2000s. Anyway, that was a project that came out of it, but there's a number of other projects. Southeast Uplift, I believe, came out of it. A number of community organizations came out of it because it was it was kind of fueled by sort of the, you know, the 70s, which came out of the 60s, sort of social change momentum. But obviously there's much, much older models like the Highlander Center. But yeah, I guess what we're talking about is the need for community-based, neighborhood-based things like the Highlander Center, where you can work these things out on a neighborhood level. I know the, what's the group that I, you know, my friends who I had on the third Wednesday show, which I guess this is a third Wednesday show, and had an organization which was attempting to do that on a sort of an anarchist neighborhood by neighborhood basis. Anyway, I'll throw it back to you, Camilo.
Well, I just think that Portland has a rich opportunity to do this because it's not so big, but it's big enough and it's small enough so that people can come together and support these kind of community efforts. So I think we're on the right track and we need to be positive.
Right on, right on. Maybe you know, instead of the roaring 20s, which came out of the apparently the pandemic of 1918, maybe we should throw all our bottled up energies that we've been accumulating in this time in the past year into exactly what you're talking about. So yeah, thank you for that, Camilo. Always good to hear from you. Looks like we've got Joe on stack, and we've got, we've only got 10 minutes left, 503-231-8187. Go ahead, Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is interesting conversation and something that I've been interested in my whole life. Transition towns. Have you heard about that movement?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay, so I'm thinking, you know, it's a collaborative thing. You know, people gather around in a circle and pass the feather, and they resolve issues, and then they get things done, sort of like dog soldiers, you know, back in the day when American Indians were socialist in the sense that they had there were groups that, you know, some people were better at acquiring food and other people were better at preparing food and other people were better at building shelters. It's very similar. And people like Map Your Neighborhood are also doing that. It's a current thing that goes on around the nation, sort of organized by fire departments, where people are preparing for exactly like what we just went through, the ice storm and the snowstorm. Very social, and you get to know your neighbors, and you find out who has what skills and who's willing to do what, and it's all as far as it's preparation. But you know, it's not like everybody is active, but it's a planning process, and it's done mm-hmm. collaboratively. So I kind of believe,
well,
you know, small is good when it comes to socialism.
I totally agree with you, and I think what a lot of the knuckleheads who are so evident at the nation's capital and a lot of places around the Northwest who are so still chanting this anti-communist mantra, that what they might be able to get, but maybe leave them aside, is that it's what we're really after is not some sort of monolithic, you know, state-controlled society that tells everybody what to do. What we're looking for is people controlling our own lives, basically, and making these transitions on our own because they're in our interests, because the state, neither the state nor the corporations are really capable of dealing with what's being thrown at us, as we see so evidently.
Well, there's so many examples of socialism throughout the history all over the world. One example comes to mind is barn raising. The neighbors, you know, help each other to raise the barn. Or, you know, it's just so many examples of the intrinsic need of humans to help each other, you know, to keep the community cohesive, because everybody who helps everybody else benefits.
Or to make the community cohesive again, make the community cohesive again, MCA. I'm just making a little joke on MAGA. But anyway, yeah, I mean, because we've lost so much, or we don't have the cohesiveness that we really need. I mean, you know, I was out going down to the end of my block and just sort of uncovering the drain from the ice just so the water could drain properly and stop, you know, it was like half a foot at the, you know, it was a small gesture, but, you know, if we even had it together so that, you know, there were people who knew that they had to go to clear their drain every time something like this happened or clear it from leaves. But no, we expect the city to do that, whereas the city is not equipped on the granular level to do all the little details, so we need to fill in, but we need to do it organized.
Yeah, and the problem is that people are afraid to be organized because their lives are based on fear. So this is the big problem. How can we get love into people's lives and less fear? Because when people become fearless, they can accomplish so much more.
Totally agree with you.
Yeah. Well, that's just my two cents.
Well, thank you so much. Good
to hear
from you.
You're welcome.
A lot of new voices today. I've obviously struck something of a chord. That's a good lesson for me. This is obviously a theme that you know, much more immediate. And again, it's a disaster, relatively small on the scale of things, but you know, I'm sure some people were, you know, I don't know if anybody died from the cold. I hope not. I'm sure there's some traffic accident deaths. Certainly not like the fires of last year, but it was definitely a major curveball that nature threw us, this storm, and it had some major impacts, as we saw from the conversation, not least of which the massive power outage that not only caused major inconvenience and possibly some serious issues for people on an individual basis, but you know, led to Fred Meyer's losing their power and throwing out massive amounts of food, which is the subject that started this whole conversation. But yeah, I'm just interested. 503-231-8187. We have time for one more caller if you want to do it. Don't feel pressured to do it. But yeah, I was going to read from this article by Michael Mirapol, "What Would an American Socialism Look Like?" to sort of set a more broader basis for the discussion, but I didn't do it. I don't know, it's kind of late. What is socialism? I watched the Republican convention, and though the word was spoken often, the only thing I learned about it was it's very bad. Anyway, this is an article came out on WAMC.org, "What Would an American Socialism Look Like?" A lot of articles like this. A lot of people are thinking newly or renewly about socialism. So, yeah, I'll just read a couple more bits. He quotes from Wikipedia. And anyway, so it talks about social ownership of the means of production and worker self-management of enterprises. Social ownership can be public, collective, cooperative, or of equity. While no single definition encapsulates many types of socialism, social ownership is the one common element. So that's what I was talking about, the need for, I talk about maybe community ownership, neighborhood ownership, but social ownership of things like, you know, warehouse spaces, storefronts, food co-ops, tool banks, things like that, that would make things so much easier. Why do we each have to have our own lawnmower? Why do we each have to have, you know, why can't we have a commercial grade a washer and dryer that can wash large items for every neighborhood? Just things like that. You know, why do we each need to have, you know, medium-sized yard devices and appliances? Why can't we have them all shared so we don't have to depend so much on the market economy? Obviously, we know that the market economy and corporations tend to have way more influence. So that's what we're struggling against. But yeah, I guess I'm arguing against, you know, in addition to large-scale social struggle to reverse white supremacy and historical inequities and the legacy of slavery and genocide and the massive expropriation of indigenous people's land and the massive inequality between the billionaire class and the rest of us and all that. How do we do, on an intermediate level, how do we start on a neighborhood basis freeing up some space? How do we pool our resources, especially in a time when we're so separated? How do we start to imagine our way out of this situation as we possibly see the end coming to this pandemic? But of course, we're going to face a lot more difficulties in the interim, you know, as a possible wave of evictions loom, unless they keep extending and extending and extending the moratorium. All kinds of stuff we got on our plates. I'm just trying to throw out on a small basis just the idea of just giving ourselves some time to try to imagine and, you know, and start some conversations. You know, how do we, you know, even if, like, you know, if my garage wasn't so full of my own darn stuff, I'd like to use my garage for, like, some community projects. There's, you know, there's lots of empty spaces around that aren't being rented, aren't being utilized. How do we, you know, we have to talk to our neighbors. We have to make it happen, folks. Well, that's about all I get to say. We came to the end of the hour. I found this very interesting. We had quite a few callers, a lot of new callers. That's encouraging to me. And I'll be back next week, like always, every Wednesday morning from 8 to 9. And every weekday morning from 8 to 9, you got talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, which also needs your support. Go to kboo.fm and find out how to support us financially and in other ways. And you can listen to all the archived shows that you may have missed. I'll be signing off for now. Thanks a lot, everybody. See you later.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
On February 1st, 2021, the KBOO Foundation, licensee of KBOO FM 90.7 Portland, Oregon, filed an application with the Federal Communications Commission for transfer of control. Members of the public wishing